right, you're listening to Saturday Morning Serial. Tom Skorumbas, Kira DeCordres, and myself will be here momentarily. I guess I'm here already, huh? Listen to a radio, local radio show about local radio. We'll come at you from multiple locations. And we'll get interrupted at 10:30 for Radio Wonderland, a radio show picking up and remixing radio. Saturday Morning Serial is a live transmission art show with a cast of many regular characters and regular radio segments based out of Wavefarm, local frequency signals transmissions, and walk-in on-air guests are all mixed in. You can Skype in at Wavefarm. We'll turn up the Skype in a second. Mic 4 has a problem. We'll check on CB radio, and we are listening to weather radio right now. Shortwave scanners, cell phones, strings, and cups, whatever else we can tune in. Usually we tune in the weekly presidential radio adjustment and Republican response. I'm not sure we're going to have time for that today. And we'll listen to back to the best radio segments of the past week. We just did that. We heard program director Katie Donnelly previewing the coming week on the air. You can call in at 518-622-2598. You can send us a Twitter message at WGXC or at Free103.9. And like I said, Radio Wonderland comes on at 10:30 with Joshua Freed remixing New York City morning radio on Hudson Valley frequencies. In just a minute, we're going to talk to Ankrumdale's Tom Ditto. And at 11 a.m., Radio Sketchpad airs this week from Alyssa Moxley. So stay tuned. All right, well, we have blasted off on Saturday Morning Serial, and I'm Tom Rowe.
I'm Kira DeCordres.
LeFou.
Oh, wait, there you are.
Yes, here I am. I'm Zero LeFou.
Zero LeFou.
Well, there's so many Toms in this outfit that I just dropped the Tom, and I'd have to be Tom Cubed, apparently.
We're all calling everybody Tom today.
Can I be Tom, too?
Well, I'm trying to avoid the confusion that that would create by becoming my mime persona.
Tom 3?
I came up with the name in 1972, I think. I was trying to think of who the hell I was. Zero is Zero Mostel, and he doesn't do anything right. He does everything wrong. It's quite funny.
But Zero Mustafa?
Mostel is a big fat man who does everything wrong. And on stage, he's very amusing. He's an absurdist, you know, a theater of the absurd. And then there's this, comedy dell'arte figure named Piero. You ever hear of him, Piero?
I have not.
Well, you wouldn't hear him at all because he's a mime character. And
we're going to do our mime set in a moment, right?
Well, that's why I brought music, because I can't show you these videos I made in the 70s. Where I invented a way to interact with a computer using a visual system called Pantomation. And it's covered in a book here that you had on your shelf. It's The Emergence of Video Processing Tools, and it's a compilation of the artists who made their own studios. And my studio was a studio in which I could perform as a mime and interact with computer graphics. And this was like 1976, I mean, before motion capture was even a word. In fact, I don't like mocap. It doesn't have the resonance for me that my own term pantomation had. Pantomation was Zio LeFou's way of interacting with the video world. You know, PRO had been around since the 1500s, even maybe earlier, Comédie dell'Arte. It had a high point in France and the 19th century in Paris. And PRO morphed into a character who always ended up like a cat on his feet, no matter what weird shit. I'm sorry. Whatever weird stuff came down, it was always possible for Pierrot to come out without any apparent scratches. So Zero was born from the notion that if you do things wrong most of your life, at the very end, you'll land on your feet. And here I am. I'm on my feet at your waveform.
You don't have to stand up for this show.
Oh, I don't. I'm sitting relaxed with a microphone. I can hear my voice clearly, and I'm all two of your listeners.
That's right. We're in the room with you.
That's really great. I'm pleased to get back in the flow of traffic. I've been hiding out at NASA and the National Science Foundation for 20 years doing... making a living as a scientist, and now I'm an astrophysicist. But back when the pantomation system was developed, and it's covered in the Emergence of Video Processing Tools, Volume 2. There are two books here, glued together, I guess, and they characterize what artists do when they get electronics. I mean, I see you have electronics here. You got your VHS player. It must be a start, and then it goes down to weirder and weirder audio stuff that I don't even recognize. It's so recent. But back then, you kind of had to build your own. So we started out with circuits that were capable of making sound from what was then the cutting edge in computers. And they were analog computers in the arts. So you remember the Moog and the Buchla and that sort of stuff?
Yes.
So I was in San Francisco making a film. It was called Atmosphere, and it wasn't fearful enough. There was no phobia in it. I couldn't bring out that scary part until I sat down with Don Buchla's modular music system, the Model 100, at the Tape Music Center and Divisadero Street in San Francisco in 1966. They gave me one night, you know, it's yours for a night. I've never seen anything like it. So I started fooling around with it, and I made a soundtrack, and it worked so well that the cityscapes, which is what I had to call the film when it was silent, finally became the thing I was trying to make, which was fear, atmosphere. So it was some scary stuff, you know, sort of like a theremin, but it had more variety in the timbres and the choices you could get. I had a six-minute film. It went viral for the day. You know, you couldn't really have a viral video, so... This film showed up in the San Francisco Film Festival, won the top prize, and ended up in the Museum of Modern Art, and I was still in college. And it was all because of that magical electronic stuff where you had signals and controls, and your head was filled with sounds, and you started wiggling banana plugs until out of the box came what was ever in your head. So...
I think we have another Tom arrived.
Yeah. Well, you guys can be Tom 1 and Tom 2. It's fine with me. Just call me...
You're a ditto head?
Oh, you know, that was
That's
unfortunate.
That's a radio term.
That was unfortunate. I married Beverly Botto. I was Tom DeWitt. I asked her if she could think of a name we could share. And she came up with this new surname, which fit us so well because we wanted to have a little ditto, and we did, you know. So we became the Dittos, went to the Pine Plains, town hall and filled out the marriage license form. And, you know, there's this place for your surname when you get married. It's not limited to bride. The bride is not the one that has to change her name by New York State law. You can do anything you want. So we wrote Ditto in, and we became the Dittos, and we had a little Ditto, and we remained ourselves, I presume so. You know, Ditto is a past participle of the verb to speak. It means having been spoken. That's what it is, and we were spoken for from that day forward. And so Ditto was a great choice. I knew I picked the right lady for my wife when she came up with that. I mean, we don't have rings, you know, things. We have a surname that bonds us. So I think that's an approach in the computer age where you can trace anybody using Google. You know, if you type DeWitt in, it'll lead to Ditto. If you type Ditto in, it'll lead to DeWitt. I'm registered. I'm in there. You'll find me.
Your circuits cross?
My record of misbehavior is pretty much recorded. Everything I do wrong is remembered by the giant big data computer around us that surrounds us at all times. So you can find my videos there. You can find some hint of what I did musically, making computers that made music. And that's why I brought along Philharmonia, because I worked with a guy named Phil Edelstein. You remember him? He came by not long ago.
Yes.
He was working with Steve Bull to do some kind of phone-in show.
It was three weeks ago?
Yeah, I didn't know Waveform existed. Well, I kind of heard about it, but I didn't know what it was.
You're in Ankrumdale?
Well, actually, I am even closer.
You're in Cairo now?
I took over Rudy Berkhout's holography lab.
That's in Catskill?
It's in Cairo.
Oh, it's in Cairo.
Yeah, pronounce that Cairo, and we won't do a shibboleth on you. So about that time, I was told there was an artist-in-residency program nearby, and I thought, well, they're audio, and I'm doing holography. I mean, how are you going to get the two together? I mean, one's silent visuals, and the other is blind sound. So here we are with blind. I mean, you can't see me. You know, I can't do my shtick here. You know, I can't show you my holograms. I can't pantomime. I can only do my voice, which is a very variable thing, and it's all over the place. And I don't know what to do with it because I don't practice that very much.
That's right. 25% of the audience thinks you're completely bald, and the other 35% thinks that you're have a beard, and 10% thinks that. Is wondering where Tom Skorumbus is.
He needs a mic, but you know
he's got his mic behind him. He isn't.
Yeah. He's speaking out the back of his head, and no one's heard him.
You can pull it.
He's got earphones and their phones, and yeah, two Toms. I'm staring at two Toms, and there's a Kira over here who's the intern.
Hello, Kira.
And I'm taking over here for the next 40 minutes. I'm sorry. This is Tom.
And Joe Malutis is hovering in the background, too.
Yeah, this is the morning show. Oh, and Galen just showed up, despite her
claim
she was going to work.
I think she was buzzing. Let's try it.
I'm going to go and do some work, she said, showing up at the door to see what's going on in here. Oh, we got 60-cycle hum. Ho-hum.
Uh-huh. Plug that in. See if it goes away.
The microphone, yeah.
Yeah, no, still humming.
Right, well, yeah, still humming. So that's why I was putting you on five there, because four has got a problem.
Okay.
Yeah. Here, you use one.
Let's share, Tomo.
Oh yeah, the two Toms. Let's do a duet.
I used to do with the Dark Prince.
Toms. We'll sing in two-part harmony now.
You know, I have to admit, I feel a little left out here. There's three Toms, and can I be called Tom? Can I be called Tom for today?
No, I think
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
My name's Tom.
My name's Tom, too.
Sorry.
Well, I think we can start drumming on our tom-toms now.
All right. Yes. And and you were slowly introducing Philharmonia. Philharmonia.
Okay, well, here we're going to get into the theoretical limitations of the abstract continuity between reality and fantasy is realized within the art community and understood only to be the repetition of the same old thing year after year until it finally dies of old age, and a horrible catharsis is known as silence. So what happened in the 20th century, the darkest period in the arts that we have ever known? And I'm here as an evangelist for the future. I am carrying with me something that you're familiar with on the one hand, which is melody and harmony, and yet new and unexpected, which is electronics. I mean, it's not all that new after all. I mean, radio's been around for the whole 20th century, but what did you hear on the radio? Did you hear John Cage on the radio? I don't think so. I mean, it just didn't have an audience. But there was a small group of people who clung to it. I call them academics. That's a sort of an anemia, is a fear that of red blood. You know, these self-protective academics clung to talentless musicians and talentless artists because anyone could be them. And that made it possible for them to propagate the idea that there was a culture of nothingness. So you remember the expression "more is less"?
More is less?
Less is more.
Less. Okay.
More is less. Less is more. And that made sense at the beginning of the 20th century when there was something of an extreme and overdoing it, you know, the Romantic period had come to a kind of a fulmination and conclusion of itself, and you were hearing super rich stuff, let's say Wagner, you know, and Schoenberg himself, you know. Remember Schoenberg? Yeah, okay. Now, you know the two sides, the two faces of Arnold Schoenberg? You know that he had a Romantic period? Can you believe it? Yeah, if you have any of that early Schoenberg, I found it kind of interesting. But he detested himself to such an extent that he decided to kill the part of himself that created harmony and melody, and he exterminated it in Teutonic fashion. You know the way they do it in Germany. You will do what you are told, and you will like it. This is a common expression in the kindergarten. And so what you did was, he said, you will make a note and then another note, and you get 12, but they can't be the same note, and that, Tom Rowe, was the tone row. Does Tom Rowe know the tone row?
Yes, he does. He knows the row tone, the tone row, the rigatoni, the tarantinato, and the tarantella.
In those particular sequences, you can change everything, but you can't repeat yourself. And if you don't repeat yourself, then, you know, you won't become a victim of more, you know. You become less. And about that time in architecture, they were throwing away the facades that came from concrete and brick and mortar. And they came up with the light, airy stuff, steel and glass, the Bauhaus. So they had this less is more aesthetic. It kind of works. So you just keep going with that. And what is it? What does it end up with? If less is more, nothing is everything. QED, so it is proven. And it's just, you know, Aristotelian logic. So you got to nothing is everything in the middle of the 20th century right there with John Cage. You know, it's like silence is music. You know, interesting contradiction, a very exciting intellectual prospect for people to talk about endlessly. I guess there was more talk and less music. Well, right about then, 1950, there was this English scientist who invented something called a diffraction rangefinder, which I reinvented in 1984 and got a patent for in 1987. Changed my life. But I was reading about it. Sir Thomas Morton. He collected Renaissance art. And someone said, you know, you have this great collection, but what about contemporary art, you know? And he said, well, if you look at Jackson Pollock, it's all noise and no signal. If you look at Michelangelo, it's all signal and no noise. And he leaned toward that, you know, all signal. Well, what does that mean? I mean, what is the signal? What are we transmitting? What are people getting out there, all two people listening to us right now out there on the radio behind that 90.7? What is the signal that you are receiving? Is it noise? I do hear some noise in the background. Yes, Tom Rowe has, you know, queued up. What is that, Tom?
I think it's PSI.
Yeah. It's, you know, I warned him that, you know, if you're going to have sound under it, it may rub me the wrong way. So I brought my own music here, and I want to bring you back to that. It's something called Philharmonia, made in 1975. It's dedicated to Phil Edelstein, who I was trying to convert to my theory. Harmony and melody were the core properties of music. And tempo is a very important part of that, too. I mean, let's go back and look at the theory underlying all that wonderful stuff that bubbled up from, I don't know, 14th century on in Western music. And it built this colossus that was too much and had to be, you know, driven into the ground by silence. And let's reinvent it. Let's go discover it, but with our tools, computers. Computers that we make ourselves from the ground up. And that's what happened. And there's this book here that has an interview with Phil Edelstein describing our work, not so much in music, but in visuals, the Panimation.
And you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre.
And only WGXC would have this nonsense on it. I mean, this is unique, isn't it? It's never happened before. Okay, so could you possibly...
Let it rip.
Play the introduction to Philharmonia. You can hear me tune up the orchestra, and then I start the computer. And it starts with one note, and then it takes it from there. And I think this runs for about 2 minutes. We are. No, it's not more. It's kind of less. It's kind of lean. And yet it contains some...
More or less.
Interesting overtones of what a computer can do. You know, it's like the signature is 60/129. I mean, you can't do that. Bob Moog had built this clock, and it was capable of counting events to a millisecond. And I had a timing system going that connected all these various sources of the harmonic notes that you might recognize are pentatonic that are separated by a minor third. And that was it. You know, I set this sorcerer's apprentice loose with its broom, and it just started to sweep up these amazing patterns that fell out. There's a repetition in there that's similar to Steve Reich and Phil Glass. I had met Steve Reich. Laurie Spiegel introduced me to him. And he had done something with tape loops and a voice, and I didn't like it at all. But I recognized what he was doing. I mean, it was an echo. Come out and get it. Come out and get it. Come out and get it. And I knew the technique.
Recognized what he was doing.
That's it.
Come out and get it.
Come out and get it. And it would be... Repetition is very important in music.
Repetition is very important in music.
Tom and 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 Tom
and
Tom and Tom
and Phil, who talk real classy.
Tom and Tom. Tom, breaking the toms with the Phil. And Phil Edelstein and I worked together on the inner electronics, but convincing him that there was something to being said with melody was not... Well, he didn't have a melody in his head, I don't think. You hear someone making music and the melody's injected into your brain and that keeps repeating, but if it doesn't pre-exist, you don't have something to go afterward. I had music happening inside my head in advance, and the problem is how do you get it to be in the air when you don't have necessarily the chops? So... I found computers would learn what I thought they should be making, and they started to do it. And Phil Edelstein knew how computers work better than I. The two of us together were a team. We worked together at WNET TV Lab. Phil tamed a PDP-8 that was broken, and Namjoon Paik has bought the thing in the expectation of having computer video, but it was over his head or under his feet or something. So we brought that computer up, and we had a really neat thing going. Then, later on, Phil met the art world, and I haven't seen much of him since. He showed up here. And what were you doing? You were having people randomly phone in stuff, apropos of the ring that we just heard. And
people are randomly phoning in stuff right as we speak.
Yeah, and it was, you know, like Steve Bull, beep, because you didn't know what was going to happen. It wasn't precognition. You know, when you wake up in the morning and there's an orchestra playing in your head, if you're lucky enough to have the orchestra at your disposal, you can share it with everybody. A computer allowed you to wake up in the morning and program it, and it was like having an orchestra in your studio. That was great. Wonderful stuff. And that's changed everything. I think now we're hearing the structures and theory that's been around for centuries coming back, and the nadir, the point of nothingness, is in the past. We're not going to go back. No one's listening to John Cage. No one's listening to the academics.
I have to interrupt you, fella. John Cage gets airplay on WGXC all the frickin' time.
I know. I'm Daniel
and all,
in the
and
line.
All six
ten.
People are hearing.
Yeah, I know. Well, John Cage is a name. I met him. I apprenticed for Stan Vanderbeek in 1965, and Cage and Cunningham were up the hill from Vanderbeek's studio. So I crossed paths, and the guy was so charming. I mean, he could just charm anyone into believing that nothing was everything. You couldn't help but love the dude. He was very, very nice. But it was hard for him to sustain the illusion that nothing is everything. So that required an army of zombies that were created in the academic community that went out and told their students, you got to do this or you're not going to be accepted. And they enforce it. I mean, if you don't kowtow to the catechism, you end up being exorcised from the academic world. An MFA won't carry you. Your thesis isn't enough.
Jared, do you want to comment on that?
I don't have a microphone here. I could.
We got a bunch of microphones.
We're going to have the battle of the Lord. Academics here. Okay. All right. Who? This is Joe. Finally, not a Tom.
Joe Malutis, new artist and resident at Wave Farm. And where are you at now? You're in Seattle?
In Seattle, yes.
At what institution?
University of Washington. Yes, and I do struggle within the academic context. You know, life is not simple within its strictures by any means. It's tough outside of it, too, to do anything sort of fairly idealistic. I think that one of the things about, you know, for better or for worse, in the kind of paranoid milieu of our culture right now, academic context seem to have a lot of exciting things going on. But sort of regardless of that, I never met John Cage. I never met Schoenberg. I do appreciate I do appreciate their innovations. And as innovators, I think they're important people. One of the things, though, I was thinking about is that if you think about the beats, you know, let's sort of take John Cage out of the equation as a kind of bête noir of the avant-garde. But if you think about the beats and the arts and the hippie culture that came out of Ginsberg and Kerouac and Corso and Snyder and all of them, you know, what were they doing? But they were actually getting rid of all of the defunct sonic artifacts that had been incrustating around poetry. So in some ways, these people who we think of as the epitome of sort of freedom of art and the sort of freedom of culture were doing exactly the same thing John Cage was, but John Cage was doing it in a much more extreme way. You know, the beats were sort of trying to get us closer to the sound of nature. And, by using things like repetition, you know, sort of somebody like Ginsberg in his use of anaphora and his attempt to bring the pulsations, just like Whitman, just like Rambo, the sort of pulsations of the howlings
of wolves
at the moon. And the cosmic revelations therein, that was all there. And if you look at it, you know, it's strange. You know, a lot of people who hold the beats dear sometimes don't have the beat ideals in mind. I mean, if you actually read beat poetry, sometimes you go back to it. It can be hard. It can be ugly. It can be just as strange or challenging as something like John Cage, but they have that kind of celebrity cultural status that maybe sort of makes us forget that they're allies in this attempt to get at the sonic resonance of the world.
Cool, dude. I mean, I can dig it because, man, I'm one of those who was born into it. I came out of the 50s, I was painting, I was a little before my classmates got wind of the idea that painting was an academic pursuit, you know, it's like, okay, the guy's crazy, let him go, and before long, I found myself in the enclaves of the upper crust, you know, I was in the Museum of Modern Art. And before I got out of college, I had two films in there. And somehow, I was hanging with Cage, and I could see, you know, the magic, the hypnotic tendency that fell out of the personality that he had. It was like a religion, and I didn't belong to it, but I could appreciate it, you know. like any religion, you know. I understand there's an inner longing in everybody to achieve that sense of awareness, nirvana kind of on earth. Mm. But on the other hand, I heard voices in my own head, and I saw visions. I was hallucinatory, and I had to paint those things, and then I had to photograph, and then I had to make movies that showed that they were moving visions, and then later in life they became three-dimensional moving visions and such. Mm. And they weren't the sounds of nature. They were the sounds of nature as processed inside my head with structures that come from aesthetics born of psychology. I have feelings, and I wanted to express these feelings in an abstract way, or I wanted to take real things and turn them into abstractions that were universal. I mean, the mime part of it was real for me because there were no words. I could just communicate with the world without having to have a translator. And I took that to all kinds of extremes I don't have time to describe now. But I was in that culture. And yet, you know, there's certain people in the 20th century who didn't pay homage to the academics, and yet we love them. Bartok, Gershwin, you know, they're just, they heard music in their head and it's so good, you can't say no to it. You got to go with it. Now, it comes to the poetry, and I got to say that something happened recently where people started to listen to the lyrics more clearly than ever before, and some of them rhyme, and some of them have meter. And in that push, there's shedding of the limitations imposed by the Catechism of Cage or the plain verse of Whitman. I just don't think that that's the universal. The universal is something that we all share, even if we have different cultural backgrounds. It just reaches across to the feelings inside inside ourselves. And I think that's emerging in the 21st century now. Here we go. Here we go. So what I'm going to ask Tom wanted to do is give you a taste of the middle of Philharmonia, where I was pitching this to someone who became a student of David Tudor and left me. And yet he retains some sentimental memory of this piece because he mentioned it when he was here. So this is Philharmonia, right smack dab in the middle of it.
That's
short.
Yeah, okay. So if you listen to the complicated interaction of the notes, it's something that a human probably would find difficult to do, you know, a tempo like that, you know. But then it's drawing on some other stuff that everyone knows, you know, simple, easily recognized harmonies. So you put the two together, and what have you got? You have what a computer can do that a human can't, and what a human loves, and a computer doesn't understand. You know, this is an interesting thing. I was talking to Joe here about poetry, and you know, you can get a computer to write poetry. It's kind of weird stuff where you, all those words, you know, there's 60,000 of them, and then they have all their tenses and everything, and you start throwing them together, and what happens? It's garbage, right? It's really, it's not, it doesn't have any feeling at all, you know. But sometimes funny, like monkeys at a typewriter, right?
Yeah. Well, you would probably hate the fact that, you know, one of the sort of latter-day manifestations of the Cajun worldview has been in conceptual writing, which precisely uses computer tools for creating certain assemblages. And, you know, it has the same maybe kind of savoir faire in relationship to the sort of world of nature and knowledge, and maybe throws things like harmony and stuff like that out the window. But that is something that I think that is, I think that's interesting. But I mean, going back to your idea of abstraction, though, I dig what you're saying about the fact that, you know, abstraction is important as a way to connect to all people at all times, or have something that's more universal. And I also understand that what happens to abstraction is that it can easily become academic. So Schoenberg's 12-tone scale can become a cliche, an intellectual cliche. Cage's gestures can become an intellectual cliche, precisely because abstraction can be easy. Or not. You know, it can be, you know, music is an abstraction. It's language is an abstraction. And so are we talking about abstraction as in kind of minimalist stripping down of things to their most primal elements, or are we just talking about the fact that we're always abstracting from the world around us to make art? Is abstract art a tautology? And I would say that sometimes I think what people maybe get angry about the avant-garde is that it abstracts too much and it leaves too much out. One of the things that I think is interesting about conceptual writing is precisely because it puts everything back in about, let's say, the sort of digital world, but it's not the things that people are necessarily looking for. You know, it's not necessarily those things like emotion and experience and the bios, but it's something like, well, what's interesting about the noise of the web and computers, and what's interesting about the way in which information is newly available for us? We were just talking downstairs about the fact that if you go look up Revolution Number 9 on lyrics databases, it's fascinating because there's like all these, whether it was done by computers or by humans, somebody had to sort of find a way to take Revolution Number 9, which is not a quote-unquote song, and translate it into a lyrics database. How do we think of Revolution Number 9 as having lyrics? But yet, each of these sites does it in a very fascinating way. And so that kind of maybe disconnect between the human world and the computer world produces some interesting poetic epiphenomena.
Okay, well, a computer is a very interesting development in the arts because it provides a performance instrument that didn't exist before. And one way to approach that is to have the unexpected, the shock of the new, something that didn't exist before because you have a tool that is complex enough to bring in unexpected events. Or you can go the other way, which is where I stand, which is you already know what you're going to do, and the computer is the tool that you handle to make something impossible possible. If you have hallucinations, if you hear music in your head, if you hear poetry coming in and out of your consciousness and you want to grab it, then you can sit down in your keyboard and you can type it out. That's neat. If it's music and the computer is able to somehow shape sound into something that was already happening in your head, then its record is available for you to feel comfortable with your own existence. Artists are what I call the functionally insane. They have something going on that is introspective and deep down inside themselves, but they are able to master tools well enough to put it in front of themselves. That's the functionality of an artist. So as I was going deeper and deeper into insanity, I had a film that I made that externalized it. The fear that I had of Urban Landscapes came out, and once I had it out there, I no longer feared the city, and that was Atmosphere, and that was followed by many other Off On and The Leap, which is a film that dealt with an existential dilemma of who I was and who I would become. Fall, which is the retelling of the myth of Icarus in the light of nuclear armed bombers, bombers that fly too close to the hydrogen bomb sun, and so on. And as I made these pieces, I cured myself, pretty much, of being the crazy person that I started out as. Artists then turn to doing things on their own that's idiosyncratic, and the computer liberates them from the industrial complex of filmmaking. And now one person with a laptop can stand up to the armies of Hollywood, and that's great. I think what's going to happen with music is similar. You got an orchestra and a laptop. And if you hear an orchestra, and many people do, then you can listen to, and it's so satisfying, you can listen to the thing that's in your head. And when you get to words, I think that it's possible to chop everything up with a computer and spit it out in an arbitrary fashion, and every reader will have a different reaction to it. But some people already know what it is. I was telling you, my grandfather could write a sonnet a day, every day. It just came to him naturally, that particular structure and that particular meter and those particular rhymes. He couldn't make a living at it, so he became a merchant. He made a fortune, and that's why I have what I call the velvet safety net of family land up in Ankrumdale. I've been there for over 25 years, hanging out, doing my thing, and now I show up here in Ankra, and it's great. It's really great to have this platform, and I'm sorry we're running out of time, because there's more. I guess we're going to skip that last little bit of Philharmonia, but if we could go out on that last little bit of Voyage. Voyage, how much time we got?
We still got 2.5 minutes.
Okay, just let me preface this by saying that Voyage is a statement about the Voyager spacecraft going past Jupiter in 1979. And I took that and made what turns out to be the first exoplanet visit that was available, short of Star Trek-like things. But this is just the way things look when you get to faraway places. And today, if you would look at my website, you'd see telescopes that can look at exoplanets. It took me away. So here's a bit of audio of a vision that I had that's coming true. You know, it's really amazing. The audio is made in collaboration with Vibeke Sorensen, and she and I were a team. WTV was a team that made about 6 videos that are on the web. Dean Winkler put them up, so look up WTV and Dean Winkler, and he made some really sharp copies of this Voyage. Voyage is a high-definition video. It's about 9 minutes, and here is...
Well, did you give the website address?
We're in Google, man. We're in Google.
So you can go to Google.
Tom Ditto or Tom DeWitt or Dean Winkler or Vibeke Sorensen. You just pepper Google with keywords and they'll or YouTube, and it'll dump it. You know, it'll dump it. WTV was our logo.
And Joe Malutis, you'll be back maybe again on the afternoon show today.
We're gonna do something then, and we also have a show next week on
next Saturday,
which will have a lot of interviews with people about experimental translation, including people like Brandon Brown and Marie Buck and Marcel Durand and Danny Snelson.
Any other last thoughts, Tommy? Any other last thoughts? We got to go out. We too much in the show today. We'll get everything in next week. Thank you again, Tom Ditto from Cairo. Let's call the whole thing off.
Thank you.
And Joe flying in from Seattle, and we'll hear more from you later today. And Tom and Kira. All right. This is The Voyage.